Calling 83531 Cameron v. State. Counsel, will you state your appearances, please?
Thank you and good morning, Chief Justice Stiglitz. Richard Cornell appearing for the appellant, Wayne Cameron.
Okay, Mr. Cornell, one moment. You state your appearances. Who's going to be arguing, please?
Jennifer Noble on behalf of the state of Nevada.
All right. You ready to proceed?
One preliminary before we start the clock, if we may, Your Honor. What we'd like to do with the court's permission is this. Ms. Hickman is here on behalf of the Nevada Attorneys for Criminal Justice. By the way, it's her first oral argument, though she's tried many a jury trial. What we'd like to do, if it pleases the court, is have Ms. Hickman handle issue one with the four sub-issues that the court has delineated. Then I would follow up with follow-up comments on them, and I would talk about issues two and three. We would leave issues four through six, or the penalty issues, to the briefs, because I think we'd run out of time, and with any luck, this court will never get there anyway. But we'd like to proceed that way, if we may.
Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
If there's any left, yes.
How much?
2 minutes.
All right, and then you can divide your time however you see fit.
Thank you.
Ms. Noble?
Thank you, Chief Justice. Alexander Chen is also
good morning, Mr. Chen.
The Nevada District Attorneys Association. And if all goes right, I'd like to give 10 minutes of my time to Mr. Chen.
Well, you can each divide your time as you see fit. The court's not going to manage your clock in that way. The bell will ring, Mr. Cornell, at 10 when there's 10 minutes left. Okay? All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Hickman.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I am Kate Hickman, and I represent Amicus Curiae, Nevada Attorneys for Criminal Justice. This morning in this case, the novel legal theory that the prosecutor used at trial, that a bullet by itself can constitute entry for the purposes of burglary, would serve to broaden the burglary definition beyond the statutory language. This court should decline to expand burglary to this kind of circumstance and limit entry for the purposes of burglary to those clearly laid out in NRS 193.0145. Burglary at its most basic level requires entry. And then that entry has to obviously be with the requisite intent. Nevada law, through the statute, clearly defines what entry is. And for the purposes of this case, it excludes a bullet on its own crossing the threshold. In order for there to be entry, one of three possible scenarios has to happen. Either the entry of the offender, the insertion of any part of the offender's body, or an instrument or weapon held in the offender's hand. And when we talk about that, what it seems to really be referring to is the control of the instrument or weapon when it crosses the threshold. Any other reasoning is contrary to the statute and is not supported by Nevada law. So when we look at territorial law and then the statutes that come from that law, where we finally get to the statutes in place at the time that this crime was committed, it seems to contemplate weapons that are somewhat rudimentary in terms of sticks, spears, clubs, firearms, the type of weapons or instruments that you would hold in your hand and then have to control once they are entered into, in this case, a car or any other type of structure.
So, Ms. Hickman, let's say if hypothetically the court were to agree that a bullet that enters a vehicle from outside of it, that would not constitute burglary as a matter of law. One, was the jury properly instructed, however, on entry? And then what effect would that have on the verdict?
So to answer the first question, was the jury properly instructed as to entry? If you look at the closing arguments in this case, defense counsel objected at the time that the argument was made that the bullet by itself entering into the vehicle could be a burglary. That objection was properly preserved in the trial court. And then through the response of the prosecutor and the court's instruction, that appeared to be a legal instruction to the jury, that that was in fact a burglary if the entry was made by the bullet itself.
Wait, did you say counsel's objection became a legal instruction to the jury?
No. Counsel's objection and then the court's response endorsing
the court's decision on the objection.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But I believe in the court's response, it referenced the law. And I believe the prosecutor at that point said the law's the law. And then in overruling it, the trial court endorsed that theory.
And you would acknowledge, would you not, that in his argument, defense counsel argued the exact opposite, that the state's theory, in fact, was incorrect on that point?
That is correct. I do believe that the defense counsel did argue that. However, when the judge endorsed it as a legal theory, overruling the objection and saying that it was legally sufficient, that is an incorrect statement of law that the jury was then able to rely on in coming to its verdict.
Do you have a reference in either the appellant's opening or answering brief for what you just said?
In terms of that the judge endorsed that?
Yes.
I would defer to Mr. Cornell as to the actual factual issues, but I do believe that in the amicus brief...
it's in the amicus brief, I believe.
Correct. And so that is what, in terms of answering that question, and going back to Chief Justice Stiglitz's question, what effect does it have on the verdict? Is at the point that that is endorsed as a legal theory, the jury is then able to rely on that entry for burglary in coming to the ultimate guilty verdict that it did in this case. And so when we talk about, and I just want to touch briefly on one of the scenarios brought up by the...
Let me interrupt you and go back to the Chief Justice's question, because I don't think there was really an answer to that. My understanding is that Mr. Cameron, in his trial objection, in his opening brief on appeal, in his response to our reconsideration petition answer, and in the supplemental brief that was filed in pursuant to our setting of this oral argument, has never alleged that there was anything improper about any of the jury instructions given to the jury. In fact, on page 17 of his supplemental brief, he says the question is whether there was sufficient evidence of a burglary. Correct?
I believe that is correct. However, if you're going to look at, do you analyze this under the harmless error standard or sufficiency of the evidence? And the question that was proposed by the court, under which theory should we analyze it? Under Gordon and Ryan, the objection was that there was not sufficient evidence to sustain either the three alternate theories of DUI or the two alternate theories of murder. And the most significant portion of those cases for argument today is that both legal theories have to be sufficient. And in this case, the felony murder theory is not legally sufficient. That is legal error. And the legal error in this case affects the verdict because we have a general verdict form, because we don't know which theory the jury used to convict Mr. Cameron. We don't know if some of them believed the bullet entry in and of itself constituted felony murder, if some of them believed willful, premeditated, deliberate murder, or if they all believed felony murder or none of them did. But when that legal error is present, And the alternative theory, in this case felony murder, is not legally sufficient. It cannot be sufficiency of the evidence.
Well, there are, excuse me.
Go ahead.
There are alternative theories even under felony murder. Factually, there could have been attempt burglary. There could have been a reaching in and a withdrawal and a shooting, even crediting your position on the burglary statute. And indeed, the gun could have been in the car when the shot was fired. So any of those theories would be sufficient to establish felony murder. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree. That is correct. However, it is impossible to separate all of those. Sorry, I thought you were going to say something.
The problem I have is even crediting your position that was error and even crediting, like, assume that the state didn't ask that question, would it, a jury find, is it, can we say beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury would have convicted on the remaining theories? What's wrong with that?
You cannot say that in this case.
Tell me why.
Speaking very generally, and I think for very specific facts, I would defer to Mr. Cornell, but speaking very generally, you have a case where the alternative theories are charged. The first degree premeditated deliberate willful murder is somewhat messy. It is not a slam dunk. And then when you add in the bullet as an entry, that is an easy charge to prove because technically Mr. Cameron got up and admitted to it, right? He said, I acted in self-defense. We know that bullet in and of itself crossed the threshold and resulted in the killing in this case. And so that is an easy thing for the jury to hang its hat on, to say he admitted to it, even if it is self-defense. No, we cannot say beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury could have relied on another one of those theories because this legal error was very significant.
I'm sorry. I know you're amicus, so perhaps I'll need to talk to Mr. Cornell or someone else. But do you know whether the record shows how long the jury deliberated?
I believe the jury deliberated for 2 hours.
Okay.
And so it was a very short time, but I would defer to counsel who may be able to correct me on that.
Thanks.
So, Ms. Hickman, then, is the argument that the impact on the jury's deliberation would be if they credited the alleged invalid theory, then they wouldn't have to determine intent. They wouldn't have to review lessers. Is that the position?
Absolutely, that is the position. If they credited that theory, they never have to go to open murder. They never have to go through the step-down instructions. They never even have to deliberate on willful, premeditated, deliberate murder because they can say that bullet crossed the threshold. That bullet entered with the intent to commit a crime inside that car. Mr. Cameron testified to that. He admitted to it.
I'm sorry, counsel. Would you agree that the balance of the evidence is sufficient to meet the deliberate, willful, premeditated murder, setting aside the felony murder instruction? Wasn't there enough evidence in the record for the jury to have found premeditated, willful murder?
Absolutely not. There was not enough evidence. I think that the court can rely on to say, similar to Cortinas, that you can discard the legal error in the alternative theory and rely on willful, deliberate, premeditated murder. Where Cortinas was very clear, there was hours spent committing the murder, different ways of trying to commit the murder. That is not the case in this case, and there is no way to say, yes, beyond a reasonable doubt, this was a willful, premeditated, deliberate murder.
Yeah, but even without the bullet entry theory, reasonable minds can differ, and I appreciate you're an advocate on this case, but the evidence, a reasonable juror could have amply found premeditated murder or felony murder independent of that. I don't think our job is to speculate whether they relied on this statement by the DA in closing argument, but rather does the evidence support beyond a reasonable doubt guilt under any of the legitimate factual and legal theories?
No. I disagree that it is just a comment by the prosecutor. Because of the objection, the way that it was preserved, and the court's response endorsing it as a legal term.
Yeah, I think if that had been argued, that might be a different story. And I'll grant you that position. But it wasn't argued. It wasn't preserved or presented to us.
You keep using the word endorse. The court's response to the objection was, I don't find a legal basis for the objection. The state may proceed.
Correct.
So how is that endorsing and saying, yes, there is somehow a legal basis for a bullet entry theory?
Well, I think it's the flip side of that statement, right? The objection that a bullet entry is not supported by law, and the court says, I don't find that as a legal basis.
I don't find a legal basis at this time. The prosecution may proceed.
Correct. But I also believe that was coupled with the prosecution's statement, the law is the law. And then that followed.
Right. And so if the prosecution makes statements and if the prosecution makes an argument that doesn't fit the evidence, that's on the prosecution. Maybe that's prosecutorial misconduct, right? But that doesn't take us outside of the realm of what appellant's been claiming all along throughout his multiple briefing, which is there wasn't sufficient evidence to justify the bullet entry burglary charge. So why aren't we evaluating it under sufficiency of the evidence? Since that's his claim, and we should not be put in the position of reframing the appellant's claims or creating claims for him.
I think that that gets to the fourth question that the court invited amicus to comment on, as to whether or not it is before the court. And I believe that it is now properly before the court. It was preserved in the trial court. The court rendered the opinion, and it is now in front of the court en banc. Supplemental briefing was requested. It has now been briefed, and it is properly before the court to consider. I want to thank you for allowing us to weigh in on this, and I would invite Mr. Cornell to come speak. Thank you.
I have a follow-up question before
Ms. Higgins.
Of course.
In terms of the Cortinas holding, the language in Cortinas says, in reviewing Stromberg error for harmlessness, the court is not confined to considering whether the jury actually determined the guilt under a valid theory, but may look beyond what the jury actually found to what a rational juror would have found if properly instructed. What do you do with that language in Cortinas?
So I think that if the jury was properly instructed in this case, if they were not allowed to consider the bullet entry theory, the felony murder theory would have had to rely on if the hand or the firearm actually entered the car. And I think that the record very generally is muddy about that. There is not testimony about exactly how far back the hand was, if the hand actually entered the car, if the firearm actually entered the car. Because it doesn't have to just be the hand, obviously. It can be a portion of the firearm.
But the record is that Cameron was 5'8", and the truck that the decedent was sitting in was a lifted truck, and that the bullet had a downward trajectory. How do you explain, and that there was stippling, so it had to be close enough that it couldn't have been from a hill at a distance. I don't know how you don't find attempt burglary or burglary by entry, either shooting in the truck or entering and then withdrawing and shooting.
I don't think that the record is that clear. I do believe those facts were all testified to, but I think at best the ME said a few feet. And I think you have to really consider how small the area we are speaking about is, right? Behind the wheel of a car, outside the window, and that threshold is a very small portion where crossing it at all is burglary, not crossing it is not burglary. And so the record is not clear that it was crossed, which is, I think, to use the word clear again, based on the prosecutor's ultimate argument, which is that they can rely on just the bullet entering alone. If it was that clear, that argument would not have needed to have been made.
What do you do with attempt burglary?
I think for attempt burglary, there has to be a desire to enter that plane. There has to be an intent to do that. And if the appellant never intended to use his hand or the instrument to cross the plane, if the intent was to remain outside the car and then he did remain outside the car, that is not an attempt burglary.
The statute references intent to threaten or frighten. I'm paraphrasing, but it's correct. The concept of that, an attempt burglary.
Correct, but that still requires the entry with a weapon or instrument in the hand, which is lacking in this case, and the intent to commit the attempt.
Sorry, I didn't mean to catch you as you were on your way back.
No, that's okay. But I think ultimately the language in Cortinez doesn't require us to find what the jury relied on. It's can you believe beyond a reasonable doubt? And in this case, the answer to that is no.
One of the issues, though, that's being pointed out about Cortinez, Cortinez and Ney both involve clear instructional error, which we don't have here. And what was fashioned in the court in Cortinez in its review, what Justice Pickering referred to about what would a rational jury have done without the instructional error. If you take out the instructional error, then we're back to what would a rational jury have done with the evidence in this case, i.e., was there substantial evidence to support a verdict on another theory, right?
I disagree. And I think it goes to what I've answered your questions about before, is as soon as the prosecutor made the argument about the bullet entry, the objection was made and it was overruled. It is not as clear as Ney and Cortinez, where there was an actual instruction that said robbery can be before or after the murder, the intent. It is still clearly legal error that was objected to, and the court overruled it, thereby endorsing it as a legal theory, which gives us that legal error.
In your theory, any time a court overrules an objection, it's somehow endorsing a legal theory?
I don't believe it's that broad.
Would it be different had the court here said your objection's overruled, state can proceed?
I believe that that is overbroad into the first point, right? Because courts overrule all the time, and it does not have the same effect that it has in this case. In this case, though, when it is a legal theory that is properly objected to, and the court says, I do not find a legal basis for that objection, the court is then allowing that legal error to proceed to the jury.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't think there's going to be any rebuttal time left. Let me start with sub-issue number four. Did Cameron sufficiently raise any error with the bullet entry theory or burglary in his briefs? I'm going to be the first to tell you, not artfully. I fall on my sword in that regard. But at pages 23 and 24 of the opening brief, I did raise it somewhat summarily. Mr. Fiedler, on behalf of NACJ, raised and discussed it much more artfully and thoroughly than I did. But I would submit, too, that the bullet entry theory was properly before the court because the state properly said, no, this isn't a jury instruction issue, it's a sufficiency of the evidence issue. But then they proceeded to argue how there was actually an entry through the plane by Mr. Cameron himself with the gun. And I came back in reply brief and said, no, that's not true for the testimony of Julie Schrader, the ME. So even though I was not very artful, I think the issue is before the court properly, particularly because the standard review is de novo when reviewing the elements of a crime. And that gets me to the point Justice Herndon was making. The jury instruction in this case followed the exact language of NRS 193.0145, nothing more, nothing less. Sometimes we get cases, and I'm thinking of Brooks v. State from 2008 as a pretty good example, where you can have an instruction that's not incorrect, but more needs to be done. And in this case, more did need to be done, but how do you do it? This court has never reviewed this very issue of what is an entry within the meaning of NRS 193.0145. So it's a difficult issue to begin with, but I will agree that it's a sufficiency of the evidence issue, and I would assert that it's de novo review. Now, with respect to the entry issue, whether the legislature intended this result,
Mr. Cornell, I'm sorry.
Yes, yes, ma'am.
So are you seeing we're analyzing this as sufficiency, or are we looking at it as an instructional error under Stromberg?
I think we're looking at as sufficiency on the felony murder burglary theory. By the way, let me address Justice Pickering's comment. This is really my issue, too, which is constructive amendment. Yes, the information could have charged a theory of attempted burglary. The problem was, is what did the information actually charge? It said, defendant on about February 11, 2020, killed Gerard Faust in the perpetration of attempted perpetration of a burglary by entering a vehicle with the intent to commit assault or battery, any felony therein, and that the killing occurred when the defendant followed a vehicle, defendant stopped his vehicle, exited the vehicle, with a firearm, approached the driver's side, shot Faust in the face, thereby inflicting mortal injuries. Well, the information is supposed to charge the theory and the manner and means to give the defendant notice. It says he attempted perpetration of a burglary by entering. I would submit you can't attempt a burglary by entering, because burglary has two basic elements, an entry and a concurrent, congruent, specific intent to violate one of the crimes in the statute. How do you, if you have entered, how do you have an attempted burglary? It would be like the shoplifter. On that theory, you enter, but you form your intent to shoplift later. Now we've got an attempted burglary. That's not what this court has ever intended in the burglary statute. So that's why when he came in the argument and said, no, the bullet enters, the bullet hasn't entered yet, but he shot it with the intent to enter and with the intent to scare, and the defense lawyer objected at that point, said you've changed the theory of the case. That's when the famous sour grapes judge, that's the law comment, occurred. So I would hope that if the court rejects ground one, that it would look seriously at ground two, which was referenced in footnote five at pages 8 and 9 of the ORR originally. Now,
I would concede that plain error review is the standard that applies to that argument.
In the brief, I said that, and I also said I don't know that it really matters. Constructive amendments, he did object. He didn't use the magic words constructive amendment, so in that regard, yes, plain error, but that's clearly what he meant. You've constructively amended the charge, and you did it to fit Mr. Cameron's testimony after he testified. With respect to the entry issue, I would submit to you that the Arizona Decker case isn't very helpful because its entry statute, Arizona's entry statute, doesn't have the held in the hand language. That's the real problem. And I would submit ultimately this is an issue for the legislature because of this language, and you can't really rely on common law to determine legislative intent for two basic reasons. Number one, common law is split on the issue of whether a bullet is an entry, but also the obvious, and I don't mean to be flippant, but Lord Blackstone doesn't define what the crime is. The legislature does. And based on the statute as it now reads, I would submit to you it's ambiguous, which means per the doctrine of lenity, it goes in favor of a bullet cannot enter. And I would also add, I don't know that the legislature would change this, the statute.
Mr. Cornell?
Yes.
So if this court were to credit that legal theory on the bullet, that the bullet is entry, was not proper, was not a valid legal theory.
Yes.
Then what?
Then I would submit we get to the harmless error, your issue number two, and here are my thoughts on that. If the trial court had simply stuck to open murder and argued first-degree murder on the theory that Justice Pickering has espoused, and if it stuck, we wouldn't be here. We're here because the prosecutor attempted a novel theory on felony murder. So, how do we approach that? Well, the problem is we have the Shad instruction properly given, and we have the top-down instruction properly given, and the jury was out a pretty short period of time for an 8-day jury trial, I think about 2 hours roughly, which tells me in all probability that they rejected self-defense, which they could have done on one of two theories as I think about it. One is to say, Cameron, you lied to the cops. We just don't believe a word you have to say. Or they could have said, Cameron, the scene evidence doesn't necessarily reject what you say, but the problem is we're instructed that to have self-defense, it has to be absolutely necessary, and we don't think this was absolutely necessary. But if it's charged as an open murder, then, especially for appellate review purposes, our position is per Schmuck, the U.S. Supreme Court case, per Rosas, Nevada Supreme Court case, per Kodiakos, as further stated in the Hedgepeth dissent, you have to consider whether the evidence couldn't fit second-degree murder, couldn't fit voluntary manslaughter. And in this case, it could. It's granted the defense lawyer didn't make these specific arguments in closing argument, but the jury is there to do what they do. I mean, Rosas made that pretty clear. You got to give them the options, and because they may reach a result that the lawyers didn't argue. That's the nature of the system. And in this case, a jury could say on the second theory of rejecting self-defense, okay, wasn't absolutely necessary, but you acted impulsively, not with deliberation, therefore it's a second-degree murder. Or they could say, you didn't act in self-defense, but if indeed we believe that the victim said what he said, and if indeed you saw this silver flash that turned out to be a vape pen, but you thought was a gun, you acted in the heat of passion, in which case they arrive at voluntary manslaughter. And a reasonable jury could come to either of those conclusions, even if the parties didn't argue. Unfortunately, we didn't get to issue number 3, which is my favorite one, but so it goes.
Thank you, Mr. Cornell.
Can I ask a question, Chief?
Sure.
I wanted to give you, Mr. Cornell, just an opportunity. One of the concerns I had moving from trial phase to the penalty phase was this issue surrounding the Tate residence and the shooting that was introduced in the penalty phase. It's kind of hard from the dry record to understand this, but is there anything that you can add that would explain what, if any, connection there was to the Tate residence and the Cameron family, if at all?
I cannot. And, I mean, I'd stand on the brief. Certainly that evidence couldn't have come in under 48045 because it was too incomplete for guilt phase. But for the reasons I stated in the brief, I don't think it could have come in penalty phase. And I hope in issue number 3, if I can have just 10 seconds, I promise. You have to look at the incidences with Leah Mazza and the carload of girls and say, did anything violent happen? Did he enter any residence? Did he do any of that? No. How then does this reflect on specific intent to kill? How does this reflect on deliberation? And I submit to you, it doesn't, and the Longoria case can't be distinguished, and the court should follow Longoria in reverse on that ground alone. Thank you very much.
Mr. Cornell.
May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Noble, and I represent the state. I'd like to sort of begin where Ms. Hickman and Mr. Cornell ended in their arguments. And that is assuming arguendo that there was Stromberg error here. What next? This court's en banc order posited some interesting questions concerning the standard of review and what it should be. And it seems to be that they've conceded sufficiency of the evidence. But Ms. Hickman stated that this case was not a slam dunk. That's true. No case is ever a slam dunk. But when asked if there was sufficient evidence to support first-degree murder and a premeditated, deliberated malice aforethought theory, I believe she said absolutely not. So it's important when this court is considering what standard of review to apply and how that operates in terms of the outcome in this case, that it look at a little bit of the evidence that we had. Just briefly, I'd like to go through some of that evidence. Now, there was some prior bad act evidence that was introduced. Leah Mazza testified that Mr. Cameron, on an occasion prior to the murder, followed her home, was tailgating her on her way home, and she was so scared she ran into her house and found her dad. And Mr. Cameron indicated that he had done that because he was displeased with her driving, but not an illegal action. Similarly, his own daughter recalled an instance in which he was displeased with a car full of teenagers who were driving. He didn't like the way they were driving. So we got out and yelled at him, and she was very embarrassed. And he admitted.
So Ms. Noble, don't. So those two incidents, effectively what they show is that Mr. Cameron was probably following this guy to yell at them, right? How does it show something more than that?
Well, what it does, thank you for the question, Justice Kadish. So it's relevant to the question of motive, because remember, Mr. Cameron in police interviews said that he was just following Mr. Faust to check on him, that he was doing a public service, that there was no anger whatsoever on his part. And so we know under 48045 sub 2, we can't admit that evidence to show character or propensity, but we can admit it to show motive and intent. And so I believe that the admission of those crimes, or not those crimes, rather those incidents, was relevant to motive and intent in this case and to refute his testimony.
Ms. Noble, but what intent is it informing? Is it to show his intent to kill, which is the intent that we're looking for in the trial, or some other intent? So when you say informs, it's being introduced for intent. Intent, which intent?
It's being introduced to show his intent and purpose in following Mr. Faust in the first place, not to just check on him, but not with respect to the intent to kill specifically, and his motive.
Well, I mean, isn't that really propensity?
I disagree.
He's acting the same way that he acted before, right? That isn't showing that he intended to kill here.
Thank you for the question, Justice Bell. I don't believe it's propensity, and the state didn't use it to prove intent to kill. But it was relevant because he had a history of following drivers from the same area, that area of Zalesi Lane, to the areas of their home. He admitted to his friend that the victim's driving made him so angry. I hate it when people make me so mad, and I hate that I was the one that got out of the car. These are all statements that Mr. Cameron made. He testified.
So because the state has the obligation of disproving self-defense as part of their production of evidence to prove murder, it's arguably intent that he was the initial aggressor and therefore can't kind of claim self-defense.
Yes, Justice Hernan, that's an argument I would agree with in addition to the other arguments that I've made. But
what he presented to the jury was that he thought the driver was possibly intoxicated, he was concerned, and when he got to an encounter with the driver was the aggressor, not him. So the fact that he had other similar instances where he followed the driver and lambasted the driver went to show that he was the initial aggressor in that dispute. I mean, I think that's Justice Herndon's point. And the state has the burden of showing lack of self-defense, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Justice Pickering, it does have that burden. And he testified that on the night of this murder, he was, quote, performing a public service. It's important when we're looking at the strength of the evidence in this case, which is relevant whether we're reviewing under Gordon and Ryan or under Cortinas and Ney, the evidence of premeditated, deliberated murder with malice aforethought. Both vehicles were facing the same direction at the time that neighbors heard the shots, one right next to the other. And it's important to note that Mr. Cameron, and I believe one of you, I'm sorry, I don't remember which one, was 5'8", about 5'8". And the victim's car was an F-350, 35-inch tires, 4-inch lift. So when we looked at the victim's body, there was The bullet entered through his cheekbone and became lodged in his cervical spine. So there was a slight downward trajectory. It was also a tall...
Ms. Noble, a downward trajectory assumes that the person's sitting upright and not leaning forward, correct?
It does.
The interpretation that you're asking the court to adopt is the downward trajectory.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Justice Stiglitz. Okay. But the other important part that would support that assumption that he was sitting upright is that his seatbelt was on. So that would make it difficult for him to stoop forward too far at the time.
Was there anything in the record, and I apologize if I missed it, about how tall Mr. Faust was?
There may be. I'm not aware of it. I apologize.
My understanding is the bottom of the window on the lifted pickup was about 4 feet 9 inches high.
4'11".
It was also parked on a hill with the front part of the vehicle sort of at the top of the hill. So any person standing outside the vehicle would have been kind of on that slope. So I think that does support an inference that Mr. Cameron had to reach either the gun or his arm into the vehicle in order to fire. However, that's relevant to the burglary issue that we've been talking about a lot today. But what I think is important is that this court remember that there is overwhelming evidence of premeditated and deliberated murder with malice aforethought. He followed this man. They were there for 3 to 5 minutes. He took the time to load his gun by his own admission. He exited his vehicle, and he shot this man in the head. That is plenty of evidence that he had time to think about the act, to consider it, and to decide to do it. He did that with malice, and that malice can be seen in his text to his friend or his conversation with his friend, Mr. Kolarchik, and those admissions later on that are introduced at trial.
Ms. Noble, I think what I'm at least trying to figure out is kind of a decision tree with appended standards. So do you agree that the bullet alone theory is not a valid burglary?
Justice Stiglitz, I don't agree. I think that it appears to be somewhat unsettled in Nevada. And I think that when we look at the statutes in the other states that amicus Nevada attorneys for criminal justice, they've made some good points. But this is an instrument. It's a tool. The person has control when it utilizes that tool to accomplish a criminal objective, an entry. And additionally, the panel respectfully premised its interpretation, its consideration of this issue on a version of the burglary statute that wasn't in effect at the time this crime occurred. That was the version of the statute that we have now, post AB 236, that requires unlawful entry and unlawful remaining. And I think equally important to their analysis was that...
Has the definition of entry changed?
Justice Kadish, no, it has not.
Okay. So was the bullet held in his hand?
The bullet was held in his hand in the gun at the time that he exercised his will to make it go into the car.
Not at the time of entry, though, right?
Not precisely at the time of entry. And so I think it's important, we're considering these issues, right, because in the amicus Nevada District Attorneys Association, their brief, they talk about drones, they talk about different pieces of technology. How's that going to develop over time?
Do you think anyone standing outside a building and shooting into it has committed a burglary by shooting the bullet that goes into the building?
Justice Kadish, I don't think that. We have NRS 202.285 firing into a structure. That has a completely different mens rea element than burglary. But assuming, and I understand that you, Justice Kadish, have rejected the idea of bullet entry, we get back to this analysis and the strength of the evidence. And I would suggest that this case is a lot more like Gordon and Ryan than it is like Ney and Cortinez. We have, in those cases, Gordon and Ryan, we had a general verdict, two legally valid alternative theories, but insufficient evidence to support either one of them. Here, we have ample evidence to support both premeditated and deliberated first-degree murder. But if this court rejects bullet entry, then we have one invalid, really sub-theory about entry, and two valid theories, including the prosecutor's argument, about entry of the gun and or the arm into the vehicle, which is supported by the forensic evidence. It's definitely not supported. And I think just the simple bullet entry is frankly the one least supported by the evidence adduced at trial. And I think that that should factor into this court's
analysis. Ms. Noble, in the Gordon case, this court specifically noted that Gordon does not challenge the legal sufficiency of any of these theories because he only challenged the evidentiary support and not their legal sufficiency, then it can stand as long as there's sufficient evidence for another theory. In contrast here, to the extent we're talking about the bullet theory, we're talking about the legal sufficiency of that theory, whether that can constitute a burglary under the law. So isn't that different than Gordon then?
Well, we're talking about that not because Cameron challenged the legality of the state's closing argument or that portion of it, because the panel raised it sua sponte. He explicitly challenged the evidence, the sufficiency of the evidence regarding entry, and not the legality of the state's argument. But let's say we continue to revisit that issue. And let's say this court decides, okay, this is different than Gordon and Ryan. We have Ney and Cortinez. In Ney, there was an incorrect argument that if the defendant robbed the victim, he was automatically guilty of felony murder based on an afterthought theory. And the defendant had beaten his roommate to death, taken the victim's property. He claimed, I only decided to take it after I killed him. There was no evidence to the contrary. And looking at that incorrect instruction about afterthought robbery and the weak evidence to support anything other than what the defendant said, this court applied a harmless error standard, reversed it. In Cortinez, the defendant contacted a prostitute, paid her, and then he killed her using ligature, and it took some time to do that. And then he stole her money and her marijuana. And again, we had an incorrect afterthought robbery Stromberg error. Again, same type of error, but there was stronger evidence. And this court used that evidence, the fact that it would have taken him a long time to kill this poor woman, to find that the error was harmless.
Right. So here we have one shot, right?
We have one shot.
There's no evidence of more than one shot. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So how does this compare then to those cases?
This compares because Mr. Cameron admitted that he was very angry after he followed this man, that his driving made him so mad. This is different because Mr. Cameron took the time to load his gun before he got out of his vehicle. They sat there for 3 to 5 minutes. They exchanged words, according to Mr. Cameron. And Mr. Cameron, it's important to note, it's throughout the record, regarded himself as almost a de facto law enforcement officer. He's buddies with the sheriff. He's having lunch with this person. He's having dinner with that person. And he invokes that throughout police contact with them. And so instead of Leah Mazza, or the teenagers that he chased before, according to Mr. Cameron, Mr. Faust did not receive his feedback on his driving the same way. He said, F you panty-wearing motherfucker. And for someone like Mr. Cameron, who is this hyper-masculine, de facto law enforcement officer providing a public service, that further supports the idea that he was very angry. But he had plenty of time, minutes, to think about the act and decide to do it. And he shot him in the head. So I think that we can definitely say that there was an intent to kill there. So definitely different facts supporting first-degree murder than the Cortinez case, but certainly facts that support premeditated, deliberated murder with malice aforethought.
Counsel, can you, just going back to what Justice Herndon was asking prior counsel about what seems to be kind of highly suspect evidence regarding the Tate incident in the sentencing phase, what was the correlation between, you know, that shooting and the Cameron family, particularly as to the defendant?
So the evidence, my recollection of the sentencing issue is that with the Lang residence, and I'm sorry you asked about the Tate residence, but there was the Lang residence and the Tate
right.
residence. Mr. Cameron had an issue with them surrounding youth supports. There was some sort of rivalry. I think it was the same with the Tates. But the Smith & Wesson 40 caliber casings, the same Smith & Wesson type of casings that were found in the defendant's car and from the same type of gun that killed Jared Faust were also found in Cameron's car. The Life 360 app showed him in the vicinity at the time of the shooting in the Tate residence, and casings at that scene matched casings in the car. So although on appeal Mr. Cameron relies on the Mason case, that was a death penalty case where the state didn't provide proper notice of aggravating circumstances. Also, he relies on Allen, another death penalty case that had to deal with the probative, with the disciplinary record of the inmate. So I think those can be distinguished. And under Silks versus State, we don't have the same standard in terms of presenting evidence at sentencing. And this court has recognized many times that sentencing judges are more than capable of separating the wheat from the chaff. And so I would submit that there was no error.
This was a
there.
Jury sentencing.
I'm sorry, excuse me. I appreciate that. That is an important correction. But either way, these were proven up by clear and convincing evidence, and the probative value versus the prejudicial effect, I think that test balances out here, because this is very similar. Mr. Cameron gets mad at somebody and he decides to use his gun. And it's all in that same neighborhood.
Wasn't the Tate residence very close to the Cameron residence?
Yes.
So how would the Life 360 app information be helpful there?
I think that's on
there.
The other one.
I'm sorry?
Sorry. Justice Bell was asking about the use of the Life 360 app, and I probably not as familiar with the record as you are, but I thought that was regarding the other incident, not the Tate. But I don't.
We'll leave that to Ms. Noble to answer.
And I believe that that was with regard to the other residents. I'm sorry.
Then I just misunderstood what you said.
Okay. Thank you. And I may have misspoke. I apologize, Justice Bell. I did hear a concession that sufficiency of the evidence is the appropriate standard, and that's exactly what was invoked in the pleadings in the first place, in the original appeal. So whether it's because this court finds there's a waiver or because this court finds that there was some sort of Stromberg-type error with respect to bullet entry, an application of that standard to the facts in this case should lead this court to affirm the conviction. And even if this court doesn't agree on the appropriate standard of review, whether you want to apply Gordon Ryan review or Dan Cortina's harmless error review, based on the strength of the evidence in this case of premeditated, deliberated murder with malice aforethought, I think there should be an affirmance. And I would also like to note that the prosecutor argued felony murder based on bullet entry, but he also argued that the evidence suggested that either the hand and the gun or the arm and the gun or the gun entered the vehicle. And so there was very good evidence to support a felony murder theory, too. But
I have a question on the standard of review for you. Cortinas was decided before Hedgepeth came down, and Hedgepeth makes reference to, assuming this is legal error here, to substantial and injurious effect rather than harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And do you have any comment on what we should make of that? I understand that Hedgepeth is a habeas case, but following that, you have Skilling, which is a direct appeal, and they repeat the substantial and injurious effect. I agree with you. I don't know that we get to all these different theories, but do you have a comment that you could offer the court on that?
Well, the only comment that I would have is that I don't know, because at least the one case is in a habeas context, whether or not substantial and injurious effect would be appropriate. But if you were to apply that standard here, we have the strength of the evidence supporting the two indisputably legally valid theories of entry, which are really the most supported by the evidence in this case. And then all the evidence that I've gone through, perhaps ad nauseum, about the strength of the premeditated, deliberated murder evidence in this case. And so if you apply that standard, I still think you get to the result of affirmance. It may be more appropriate to apply. But I know that As recently as 2020, in an open murder case, Newsom versus State, Cortinas was what was applied by this court.
And what do you say to counsel's argument that the objection exchange that happened in front of the jury on the bullet entry theory and how that may have prejudiced the defendant by having that kind of objection and made in front of the jury with all the this is the law and all those comments?
I tend to disagree that it's tantamount to Stromberg error just because the prosecutor makes a statement and objection is overruled. I don't know that that's tantamount to jury instruction Stromberg error, and I would disagree on that point. But even if it was, even assuming if it was, I think under any standard of review that this court applies, given the evidence in this case, the important thing for the state is that it gets to a position of affirmance. And I'd give the rest of my time to Mr. Chen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Noble.
Good morning. May it please the court. Alexander Chen on behalf of the Nevada District Attorneys Association. I have two points that I'd like to make regarding this case that hopefully differ a little bit from what's already been discussed by both parties. And one of them has to do with whether this court should be reframing the issues that are raised by the appellant himself. And I understand the urge because I know that this court wants to get the law right, wants to make sure that trial courts are able to follow the law to the best of their ability. I understand this. However, the danger of going beyond is that by doing so, it really negates the appellant's responsibility to raise cogent arguments under Maresca. And for instance, I saw Mr. McCornell apologized and said, I wish I would have artfully done something, and I certainly appreciate it if he feels that way, that he inartfully wrote his opening brief. But this case, no matter what the court decides, and hopefully it affirms, it's not over, because this court knows that there's going to be post-conviction, there's going to be an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim later, and you're going to ask whether there's prejudice as to whether, if Mr. Cornell had raised this issue properly, whether it would result in a different outcome. So ultimately, I think it's important that the court sticks with the issues raised. And at some day, if this happens, this court will be able to look at the error properly, and the error under post-conviction, and whether there's been sufficient prejudice. So I would ask that it not extend beyond what was presented to it. As I mentioned in our brief, the Polk decision is a troubling one for us, because as much as I would like to try to answer the briefs correctly and approach all the issues, these briefs can be complicated. And sometimes the issues are framed in different ways as well, in which the state might have chosen a way to frame an issue, and then on reply, you see that there's an argument that somehow we violated Polk and that we refused to actually address the issue. I believe Mr. Cornell, in his reply brief, in fact, explained, there's a reason that we have reply briefs, because the state is taking an opportunity to go after us for something in the way I said it. Certainly the state doesn't get a rebuttal, right, when it comes to appellate briefs, but I think they even recognize that there are situations in which things are maybe not artfully said, but it's the court's responsibility, hopefully, to just stick with the issues at hand. As we said, we do believe that this is Ryan and Gordon type of error, but if this court is going to look at this as instructional error, the one thing that I believe it's important to note is that when you look at the cases like Ney and Cortinas, the emphasis that's put on the defendant's own statement. And this kind of goes back to one of the questions I believe Justice Cade started and Justice Bell had asked about as well, and that regards these prior bad acts that were introduced. And I think, although everybody is sworn to tell the truth when they're on the stand, ultimately, the jury, oftentimes the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, don't really know the individuals that are testifying. They're sworn to tell the truth, but we don't know anything about them. So by having a context in which you could say that Mr. Cameron has not done this once, right? If I stole from you, the first time you might say you're willing to give me something, but the second time you would say I'm not going to give you money because Mr. Chen simply doesn't follow through. His word means nothing. We should be putting an emphasis on the truth, and I think what happens when you look at Ney and Cortinas is that it almost incentivizes to a certain extent that a defendant makes a self-serving statement that can't be disproven, or at least that attempts to make it so that it can't be disproven.
Chen, with respect to the prior bad acts, if used to prove intent, mm-hmm. does that have to be tethered to the intent that is to be proven in the case, like the charged intent, or not?
I don't believe so, Justice Stiglitz, because ultimately in this case, you have this individual and there's no other eyewitnesses to this case. So you have Mr. Cameron as the only living person who can testify to at least his version of events. And ultimately, if you believe that he was doing this out of the goodness of his heart and out of his responsibility to be a good citizen, if you hear that he's not always doing this out of the goodness of his heart, that he's having other situations where he's scaring a poor girl who's trying to go home and she has to run into her mother's house, I think that negates his self-interested testimony.
Well, then is that impeachment or is that propensity? I'm really trying to ferret out the application of the prior bad acts and where they properly should sure. be appended.
I don't believe it's propensity. I believe it goes to the intent of his following of the individual, and I also believe it does go to impeachment to a certain extent as well, because his version is that he's just a good person doing this. And ultimately, it's up to the jury to determine whether or not those facts are correct, and the jury rejected his version of events. And I think it's important when this court, if it looks at this under harmless error analysis, that it doesn't put too much weight on the defendant's self-serving testimony, because ultimately...
Do you think in the absence of those bad acts, the jury would have just accepted his story?
No, Your Honor, because in my understanding of the facts, he told so many versions of events. He even admitted that he lied, and I know that we're not allowed to say lied to people in court, but he admitted that he lied about various things related to the case. He lied about his version to the police and then his version that he was testifying to on the stand. I think that the bad acts just simply supported that this is not an individual who was simply trying to do the right thing, that he was looking for this fight and that he was going to follow this person and put himself in a position where he wanted to shoot into the victim's car. So ultimately, I'm hopeful that this court, if it looks at the facts, will see that his statements are incredibly self-serving. And much like Ney's statements were incredibly self-serving. I mean, he was the only person who was present in the apartment when he murdered his roommate with a baseball bat, or when they left out in the field, I believe, by Lone Mountain. So it was an incredibly self-serving statement that he made. And ultimately, under Crawford, yes, he's entitled to a running instruction. He's entitled to self-defense and everything else. I don't deny that. But ultimately, it was rejected because the jury simply felt like this is a crazy story. And we have Cameron, who didn't call the police. Mr. Law Enforcement doesn't call the police. The jury's able to consider that and say, we're rejecting outright your version of events. And that's the reason you're being convicted.
Let me ask you a question on the bullet entry, because we've been having this discussion, yes. And a lot of times the terminology being used is legal theory. How do you differentiate between legal theory and factual theory? Because to me, premeditated and deliberate murder is a theory, legal theory of first-degree murder. Felony murder is a legal theory of first-degree murder. Child abuse is a legal theory of first-degree murder. Bullet entering a car is a factual theory of how to get to felony murder. Yes. Do you differentiate in the same way, or do you differentiate any differently in the definitional things of legal and factual theories?
Yes, I agree that it's a factual theory, but I think that ultimately that was one theory, which if this court still finds that a bullet entry is not a proper burglary, that it can still rely upon every other theory under Gordon and Ryan to say there were still legal theories that support this verdict. However, we're not willing to endorse a bullet entry factual theory as an actual burglary. And I believe my time is up, so I appreciate the court's time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Counsel. All right. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will stand in recess. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today.